guess what? I did it again.
How is that possible?
I don't know. Welcome back to the Tape Crusaders. This is the Real World Podcast, episode 12 of the Tape Crusaders, as we take a deep dive through the history of Batman on film. I'm just going to put it out here right now. For the second week in a row, I didn't hit record for the first 10 minutes or so of our discussion. So I'm just really testing how much my co-host Mike Thomas will put up with from me before he just fires me from this thing and it goes back to being just articles online where people hate him.
Non-existent.
Yeah. So my bad. We're back again. Luckily, we weren't doing so well this time. Last time it was like, oh, such good content, and it's gone forever. Now, I think we're gonna do better as we go through this episode again. So today we are going to be tackling Mask of the Phantasm and Batman and Mr. Freeze Sub-Zero. Both of these spun out of Batman the Animated Series, which is so daunting that we just keep on putting it off to the point that we're actually tackling things that span out of it before we get to it.
I'm basically just hoping, like, the Lego movie gets here and I can be like, oh, sorry, Matt, we didn't get to it.
We have agreed. Lego we'll Batman is the last one for a while, so if it comes out before we get to it, sorry.
Next week I'm going to be like, hey, there's that Dracula Batman. We should really watch that Dracula Batman. I think a whole episode is required for that one.
Yeah, Mystery of the Batwoman, and so on. So these two films, as fate would have it, smacked you right in the face while you were out in the real world. Not the real world as in this podcast, the real life world, three-dimensional one, where you walk around and go about your business. I believe you found them in a bargain dresser, not a bargain supermarket. Bin.
It was not a bargain bin, it was a bargain dresser in my local supermarket for $6 a piece. I had to pick them up, obviously. The fate was too much in that situation. I could not deny it. And it led to a pleasant surprise, which is a tease for a tease at the end of this episode. You will not get the reward now or even in an hour, but just know something good's coming.
Yep, we are setting you up for a fall, everybody. That's what we do here. So, as logic would dictate, as Mask of the Phantasm came out first, that's the one we're going to talk about first. So, released in December 93, a year after Batman the Animated Series had been on. Warner Bros. Liked how well it was doing. Obviously, it was one of the biggest things in the world at the time. Toys and Happy Meals, you name it. That's how you know you've made it. So they say, hey, let's do a special feature-length, straight-to-video special episode. And the animators are like, yeah, that sounds cool. And then they say, okay, we're going to release it theatrically, and you've got 8 months. Go. So that led to it not making a lot of money when it came out. But it is actually very good, and I'm sure it more than made up for the losses on sort of home video release. It's a sort of cult favourite. Up until Christopher Nolan got involved with Batman, public opinion was that this was arguably the best of the Batman films. We've watched all of them that would have been out at this time, or at the time of Nolan's one coming out. Would you say that is accurate?
Close to it, I would lean to the 66 Batman, but I obviously am a bit in the bag for that one. But it'd be perfectly fair to say that this was the best Batman.
I was genuinely shocked when you said it last time. I'm not going to patronize you by acting shocked again. This is from the people that did the animated series, so the big names you hear over and over again when talking about that are Bruce Timm, Paul Dini, Alan Burnett. But this thing has 4 directors and 6 writers officially credited, so all hands on deck to try and get this thing made in 8 months. I think it's pretty impressive that they actually pulled that off. It wouldn't be possible to make an animated film of over an hour in length in 8 months, I don't think, at this point, but hey, they did it. Draws a little bit of inspiration from Year One, Year Two, and I mean, they say that Citizen Kane was one of their inspirations, I guess, when it comes to the flashbacks.
Well, The Dark Knight has influenced, you know, the Power Rangers movie coming up. So
that's true. So, Mask of the Phantasm deals with the titular Phantasm, although they are never actually mentioned by name in the film. But the Phantasm is a new vigilante, shows up in Gotham, and starts just straight up murdering mob leaders, not messing around. Basic Under the Red Hood stuff. Standard Batman trope, new vigilante, kills people, turns out it's someone he knows. Shock horror. So the people of Gotham falsely believe that this person is Batman because he keeps showing up on the scene shortly after someone's been killed. So it's like, oh, Batman did it. Because obviously he just decided to now. Pressure is put on Gotham Police to bring in Batman on murder charges. Jim Gordon's having none of that because Batman is beyond reproach, apparently. Meanwhile, in the secondary plot of this film, which is in no way related to the primary plot, Bruce's ex-fiancée, Andrea Beaumont, shows back up. And basic Scooby-Doo logic would dictate that the only other character you meet in the episode, or in this case film, is the mystery person. Sure enough, Andrea is the Phantasm. Her dad was involved with all these criminals and the Joker. Joker fights them both. Big explosion. Andrea and Joker are missing. Bruce is very, very sad, as you can tell by the very, very sad music and his sad face. But then he realizes she's alive but gone. And nothing has really changed, except we got a nice little look into the mind of and the heart of Bruce Wayne. So, I mean, broad strokes, I know, because we talked about this 10 minutes ago before I realized we weren't recording, that you don't really love the main story of this film so much. I mean, what is it about this plot that doesn't do it for you?
I think the core issue is that it's maybe it's not even a plot. I think the overall general mopiness of Bruce, the dourness of the tone of the story, is something that I can't ever fully get on board with anymore. I think I've seen too many interpretations of Batman where there can at least be a steady flow of comic relief or bright colors. So when you combine like the dourness with just the mopiness of it all, it's just kind of like, it's just not as fun. And I kind of think that this really stuck out to me. I think this hit me much more with Return of Joker when I watched all these films back about 4 or 5 years ago. I just feel like the Joker is such a crutch for these animated movies that it's just like, he feels so shoehorned into so many stories that, like, let's do something different. Like, we don't need the Joker in everything.
I think a common idea is that he was a mandate from Warner Bros. And that the story they wrote didn't feature him.
Yeah, and I mean, that makes sense. And I think they actually even did a pretty decent job of incorporating him. But, you know, like the fact that the movie comes down to
a fight with the Joker.
A showdown with Batman and Joker again. It's just like, really? Come on. Like, this should have been a little bit more.
There is definite Joker fatigue.
Yeah, which is crazy because it's not that I don't like the Joker. It's not that I don't like Mark Hamill's interpretation of it. It just felt like such a crutch. It felt so shoehorned. It didn't feel organic. And I think, I don't know.
That's the part for me where it falls apart. I actually like the kind of the mystery detective noir-y story they're telling of who is the Phantasm, even though we know, obviously, and all that. The flashbacks are sort of hit and miss. The bit where it falls apart for me is basically as soon as you canonically find out that Andrea is the Phantasm, the film kind of collapses in on itself and it just becomes a very formulaic, and now Batman fights Joker, even though that wasn't really the story they were telling at the beginning. And it just comes down to, let's fight the Joker. Now there's an explosion. Oh, I guess he got away. Ah, well.
Yeah. And it was kind of interesting how Andrea was not your typical, not your typical Batman woman. And like, kind of like, not a damsel in distress type of character at all.
No, not at all.
Clearly held down by the patriarchal society, and that the lives of men have dictated so much of her. But I don't know, it was just a little bit too dour for me. There just wasn't enough spark to it.
Even with Bruce outside in a gi, practicing his, what he calls jiu-jitsu.
It's called jiu-jitsu!
And she just takes him down immediately.
Who's in tight? Yes. What? My God.
That was quite a scene. if you're used to, very dark colors, very dark color palette Batman, that is quite a scene to watch.
Yeah, and I think what's kind of... this movie doesn't get credit for, credit might not be the right word, but what doesn't get like really acknowledged for is that you get to see a lot of the origin of Batman in this. Like, we see Batman starting out in the flashbacks here.
That I think one of the strongest parts of this film is when he's, because we see him meet her for the first time all these years ago. We see him go out on his first he doesn't have the bat suit. His first time in a just balaclava fighting criminals, very reminiscent of year one. It's when he goes to the graveyard and he's talking to his parents' gravestone and he's saying, it hurts a little bit less and, surely it would be okay. like he feels he owes his parents revenge by fighting crime, but he's met this woman who actually makes him feel vaguely happy when he's been very depressed for a long time, and like that bit is it gets me a little bit as he's sort of trying to fight fate and trying to choose between his mission he'd set out for years and he dedicated himself to for so long and this woman. And then obviously she leaves him and he turns to Batman. I thought that was all very well done.
Yeah, I don't know. There's plenty of things to like about this movie for sure. I just think the story itself is kind of just didn't grab me quite as much as other Batman stories have done. But there's plenty of things like I love, like this is for me the Alfred I knew growing up, which is probably why I was pretty okay with Jeremy Irons' interpretation of Batman, because it felt of Alfred, it felt so close to this. It's very dry. It's very just like, this is all ridiculous and I'm going to make fun of it constantly. Yeah.
Needling him all the time.
Yeah. It's, you know, it doesn't have the warmth. It doesn't have the depth of Michael Caine's Batman, obviously, but you know, I think it's a totally fair and fun interpretation of Alfred in general that this universe or this version of Batman doesn't probably get enough credit for in some ways. But I love some of the, you know, there's some definitely some moments throughout where you're like, ah, we're watching a movie instead of just a TV episode. Like the opening sequence is just beautiful. You have this haunting music. They take you on a tour of Gotham that doesn't look especially good because it's kind of out of place with the rest of the animation, and it doesn't look good in its own right. So, but it's still like a really great way to be like, hey, this is something different. This is bigger than what we normally do.
Look how much money we spent on this.
Yeah. Probably not the best use of funds, but we did it. So that's like really nice. I like that. Yeah. I like those touches.
And it's got the look of the animated series that is so strong always. It's got the soundtrack that is always so good. All the voice work is pretty good. Like all the mobsters, a lot of them voiced by people that have, you know, played mobsters a lot on film. I think all of that is really strong. The sort of, you know, the look and the sound of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it deserves a lot of credit. Like it was definitely ambitious. I'll say that. Even if I thought the Joker stuff was a crutch, the rest of the story is pretty ambitious. You know, they don't really pull a lot of punches. We see Batman bleed here.
Yes.
Which came across as notable to me. I don't think I ever recall seeing that in the cartoon.
Speaking of not pulling punches, you know, obviously I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the entire animated series going. I'm sure someone who's listening to this is going to immediately go, actually, in episode 301, they do ask questions about the sort of merits of vigilantism, which to me, it strikes me as something that they didn't really do much in the animated series. And for a, you know, what is basically a kid's cartoon, it's quite a big question to ask, and it's a surprisingly mature question to ask, I think, as, you know, at the beginning, it kind of seems like this politician figure is the Phantasm and is doing it to get rid of Batman or whatever, but he is, either way, he is coming down on Batman for, you know, how much he gets away with. And you get Jim Gordon, basically, he doesn't really have any proof that it's not Batman or anything like that, but he just, that they openly are doing this thing where Gordon is just like, nah, Batman wouldn't do that. Batman's allowed to do it. No one else but Batman can.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does deal with this sort of notion he's a fascist that does come up all the time. Something that blew my mind, he says to Andrea when he finds out that she's the Phantasm, he says, but what will vengeance solve? And it's like, Bruce, can you hear yourself talking and do you know who you are?
Yeah. And I think that's possibly part of the issue. I think they frame this movie in a way where it's hard to appreciate a different point of view other than Batman is right for doing what Batman does. You know, like he has all the, like the only person talking against it is the, you know, the asshole politician. Mm. All the characters we're meant to sympathize with are totally fine with it. But I think, you know, I think we've seen now that it can be much more, that question can be asked in a much more nuanced way. Like, it doesn't, like, this almost feels like it's being, like, I mean, actually, Dark Knight Returns is not even nuanced, but I think it presents a far more balanced view of, in some ways,
the question. With our Greek chorus.
And Red Hood obviously tackles it in a far more, I would consider emotion, I think they tackle it in a more of emotional response kind of way, but equally effective.
That being said, I think it is you know, that they would do this at all in a show that could have gotten away with just being Batman punches people and uses cool gadgets. You know,
for sure.
That they do and deserves go a lot here of credit even a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joker does feel very shoehorned in, but I do like this idea that him and Batman are sort of running parallel investigations into Phantasm as he's sort of going through his checklist of who he thinks it could be. At the same time, Batman's looking into it.
That's absolutely cool. I think one of the areas that Batman the Animated Series kind of struggled with Joker is that, and I think they kind of understandably borrowed it from the 89 Batman, which is that they kind of just made him like a mobster. And then, you know, he became insane. I think they do the chemical bath, or they explain it was the chemical bath in the show. But I always found that to be, like, that's my least favorite interpretation of Joker. Like, I either rather not know, or I do like the, despite its other issues, the Killing Joke mythology, I think is kind of at least a little bit more interesting.
Yeah. For sure. I don't know, not a huge amount else to say. I do really like the World's Fair stuff, but that's just my personal taste. I like seeing these sort of old-timey visions of the future, and then I like how it's all broken down when Joker's in charge of it. But that's got nothing to do with the quality of this film. I personally like it quite a lot. It's been sort of left behind by more modern, more sophisticated takes on Batman, but it's certainly, you know, for an animated TV show aimed at kids to produce a film that, in my opinion, kicks the ass of everything Tim Burton made, everything that Joel Schumacher made, etc. On, I can't remember the budgets for those films off the top of my head, but certainly for a lot less money. Hats off to them for doing that, and a huge testament to the strength of the animated series, which we probably just will never get to. Just
that's what I'm counting on.
We're afraid of it, basically, is what is being said here. For now, though, we've got another film to go through today, and we'll dramatically plan the future later. So this is another film born out of the animated series, Batman and Mr. Freeze Sub-Zero. They only did two films, to Mike's surprise. There is Mystery of the Batwoman, which came later, but that is born out of the New Adventures of Batman and Robin, or whatever it was called, which was the sort of inferior follow-up to Batman the Animated Series. So this came a lot later, March 1998, which is a while after the animated series had finished. It's a weird trend, because the same with Mystery of the Batwoman, that came out a few years after the show it came from had finished. But hey, I guess they wanted to see it off with a big hurrah, and maybe as soon as they finished the animated series, they started work on this. I don't know. So this is released March 1998, directed by Boyd Kirkland, who has quite a link to our podcast series, because in addition to working on the animated series and Mask of the Phantasm, he directed some episodes of Wolverine and the X-Men and X-Men Evolution, which calls back to our Excellent Adventures podcast miniseries. So hey-ho. He also co-wrote it. And one notable thing about the production of this film is that it actually got delayed by more than a year because Batman and Robin was met with such terrible, terrible public reaction. And obviously this shares Mr. Freeze as the main villain, so they were a bit worried about damage control, so they put it off for a year. So, cowards, I would say.
That's fair.
Yeah. I mean, the plot of this is actually incredibly simple in that, Mr. Freeze appears in a very acclaimed episode of the animated series and a less acclaimed follow-up. After that, he's been living in the Arctic with his frozen wife, Nora, a small Inuit boy, and just hanging out.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Yeah. And he's just hanging out. Mostly naked in the freezing cold, because he doesn't feel the cold, obviously. And then a submarine, for some reason, crashes into their lair they live in, and it puts Nora in critical condition. So he comes back to Gotham, seeks out this scientist dude, who says, she needs an organ transplant. Which organs? Dunno, doesn't matter. Roll with it. It turns out the best match for Nora is Barbara Gordon, aka Batgirl. So Mr. Freeze kidnaps her. Well, she actually sort of goes willingly and doesn't realise the gravity of the situation. And then Batman and Robin have to find her. They do that on an oil rig. A fire starts. They all work together to escape. Mr. Freeze seemingly condemns himself to death. Batman attempts to save him. He falls to his apparent doom. But then he's obviously alive, and he sees a TV report at the end of the film wherein Bruce Wayne has spent a lot of money to cure Nora Freeze, and he just walks off into the snow with his pet polar bears. Don't know what happened to the Inuit boy, but probably best we don't know.
He got it on the ship at least, right? Like,
yeah. But like, okay. Who knows what happened from there? Like, I don't like this film. I get the sense that you do, and you are probably higher on it than you are Mask of the Phantasm.
No, but I think what this film did was remind me of
was remind you how good Mr. Freeze is in the animated series with his tragic backstory.
It's been so long, I couldn't even really attest to that. I think what this movie does is remind me of how much humanity is in the Mr. Freeze character.
Mm.
And that it's kind of a shame that his gimmick is so hard to work with in a proper film. Because it's like, I was like working through it in my head. It's like, how do you possibly justify this in like the Nolan universe? Can you justify he lives, his blood is now runs cold like he has an ice gun, like I don't sure know does. If you can just yeah like it's and
yet, I mean you could easily give a character his you know like his, you could, his wife is cryogenically frozen, he's an expert in cryogenics, so he uses an ice gun or something like
I
that.
Guess like he I doesn't feel like need to like the only thing to do
yeah he doesn't necessarily need to be cold-blooded himself
but I think the Mr. Freeze character is kind of perfect for Batman, actually. Just because it, you know, while the Joker is obviously the yin to his yang, Mr. Freeze is much closer in reality to Batman. You know, Mr. Freeze just sees the crimes against him or life's crimes against him as more in the micro as opposed to the macro. He doesn't understand. Like, he's not going after, at least he doesn't think he's going after the root causes. He's trying to solve the problem right in front of him, which is his wife is sick, he needs to save her, as opposed to Batman, who's able, like, I need to fix the issues that have caused this to happen.
To be fair, though, Bruce's parents are dead. He can't save the direct issue.
Oh, no, for sure. I think that's totally irrelevant. I think I think we have enough evidence to suggest that Bruce Wayne would probably follow Mr. Freeze's path if the situations were reversed. And I think that's probably something that would be really worth exploring in another Batman, Mr. Freeze story. Other than that, though, a lot of this feels very rushed, very put together with minimal thought.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the opening scene with Batman and Robin taking on a couple of robbers, I mean, like, completely irrelevant to anything going on. Just like, let's have an opening action scene.
Yeah.
The stuff with Barbara actually was not as cringy as I expected.
I think she's one of the better parts of this film. I think she's like really feisty, and I don't know, like every interaction between her and Dick Grayson, like it's not your typical.
She gives as good as she gets.
Yeah, like for sure. Yeah. She comes across, it gets a little bit problematic as she sort of descends into just the damsel in distress, but
it's almost like
she's pretty good, I thought.
And what's weird is that they almost felt entirely self-aware about that, and it wasn't really till like literally the last second where she became that. Like, she's basically rescuing herself, and then unfortunately, like at the last second, she can't do it by herself, which is kind of like too bad.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely not the cringy total damsel in distress that you would be expecting. I didn't really like her voice work that much. It felt very stilted and didn't really feel alive in any way. But yeah, I mean, this movie is kind of weird. I mean, like the fucking Inuit kid.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Who knows, man?
What the fuck were they thinking? Like, I mean, and obviously, what they're thinking is let's humanize Freeze, and like, of course, like Victor Freeze is not the total douchebag. Like, he is a human being. It's great that they were trying to show that. Oh boy, so cheap though. So cheap to do it in that way.
Well, he's in the Arctic. Who else is he going to interact with?
Yeah.
Except all these copious amount of research stations with TVs and stuff.
We didn't really get an explanation for the submarine, I actually kind of like that as kind of like a root cause. Just like total reckless, you know, action leading to Freeze having to take things into his own hands. And which I think that's a core part of Freeze, is that he's not an evil person. He's just become too single-minded, too focused on this one thing with no sense of consequences or anything like that. And, you know, there's just like, there's a human being there. And I think with Batman, like, any comic book story, when there's a human being behind the villain, it's just infinitely more interesting. And I think I said, it may remind me, one, Arnold like was by far the best part of Batman and Robin, and as we talked about at the time. True. And he actually really nailed a lot of the human moments there. Some of the few things that really popped off the screen for that film. And, you know, I think Mr. Freeze might be one of my favorite comic book villains.
I think the thing that holds him back from that status is, where do you go after that? After you've told the one story?
And what I think is that the medium of comics is wrong for Mr. Freeze. Like, Mr. Freeze is one of those villains that when you have 5 seasons of a TV show, you plug him into this, like, maybe like 4 episode arc that you stretch over a couple seasons, or like 6 episode arc where, like, you get to know him, accident happens, a year later, like, you get the payoff to it. Like, that's the kind of character Freeze is. He's not one of those villains that you perpetually come back to time and time again. Like, he's good for that one movie or that one arc in a show. And unfortunately, the medium of comics, the medium of animated TV shows doesn't really lend itself well to that. And it's a character destined to get overexposed, overused, and kind of bastardized.
But this is the thing. He's in 2 episodes of the animated series. And
really? That's it?
Yeah. Literally, there's one that is the most famous episode of the animated series, which is A Heart of Ice, which is early in series one. Won awards, it made the entire show get attention from the mainstream, etc. It's the Mr. Freeze story. And then he appears in the second to last ever episode, which is like 60 episodes later or something like that. So he really isn't in it that much. And my thing is, this just... Because I have seen that episode a lot. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head, but that is one I've seen a lot. And this isn't as good as that. And it just feels a bit unnecessary, given they handled him so perfectly. Like, he comes back for a less elegant appearance, and it's like, oh, okay, fine. I don't really see the point in this, because not a lot really happens. You know, like, it just felt like... Because his episode sort of ends with him imprisoned and sort of wistfully looking on. And they thought, it would be nice if Bruce could help him out with Nora. Let's do a film where it ends with them on sort of good terms. Because it's just a lot of it just sort of happens. And it's like, okay, cool. There's a motivation for him to come back. And, oh, Barbara matches. Okay, that's fine. And then everything else just kind of happens until the end. And I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is not a great movie. This is not great storytelling by any stretch of the imagination. I don't want to imply anything else. I just think the Freeze character is just one that I think is really interesting. One who rejects a lot of the tropes of Batman villains in general. Mm-hmm. And one that I wish was adapted in a way that got him a little bit more respect. But it's kind of mind-blowing to learn that he only had 2 episodes in the show.
I mean,
so that's actually kudos to them for not overexposing it.
Yeah, I'm sure he popped up a lot in all the other animated shows they did over the years, but in terms of the big one, he's in it twice. Anyway, I did check when watching it. I was going through, like, all the episodes, and it says featured villain, and he's only in 2 of them, so I could be wrong. But as far as I know, only twice. Yeah, and if anyone's... sort of hungry for some Mr. Freeze. Scott Snyder wrote a very good one-off Mr. Freeze story as part of his run on Batman. Go find that. But you, when you bought this bargain of a film on DVD, I believe you were thrilled to find the contents, not just the film.
Oh no! So, man, as we this is what we like to call a callback.
Yes.
In the very first episode of Mike and Matt's Excellent Adventures, we discuss how I got to pull out my DVD copy of X-Men, which was the first DVD I ever owned back in 2000, and either late 2000 or early 2001.
And Sub-Zero is the last DVD you will ever own.
It's actually quite possible the last DVD I'll ever purchase. It was a total fluke moment. And those old days, the DVDs, there was such thought and care put into them. There was the packaging, the special features, the packets inside, the graphics when you on the menu, like... You felt like you were getting something that you could hold on to for a while. Maybe not passed down to your kids. Couldn't be sure it would last you that long. But you got something that was a little bit more than just those magical
play movie.
45 minutes. Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I go here, I to my local supermarket, get my turkey, get my Dr. Pepper, and I see these two fantastic stores waiting for me. Because who else could they possibly be waiting for?
No one.
And the packaging, flimsy, easily breakable. They look like leftover DVDs that they're just like, leftover DVD cases, and they're like, okay, what can we throw in here? No thought or care put into the world. Then you turn that back. Then you see the Mask of Phantasm special features, and your heart sinks because they're only advertising the theatrical trailer and some subtitles. And it's like, what happened to America? We used to be about things. We used to be about something. If not multiple things, at least something. Then you turn to the back of Sub-Zero.
Mm.
And Matt, what did I see? I'll tell you what I saw.
Okay.
I saw some special features.
Yeah?
I saw two special features in particular. One, a game. Yes, a game. I will get to hunt for Mr. Freeze, and I will get to tell the world all about it.
Oh my god.
And this other one. An instructional video on how to draw Batman.
Oh my god, please tell me you've drawn Batman.
And I will. And I will share it with the world.
Guys, who says that the world is going to hell? Like, look at all this optimism we have. These things that are coming our way.
Ladies and gentlemen, sorry to participate in the gender binary there. People of Earth, my analysis, my breakdown of the special features of the Batman and Mr. Freeze, Sub-Zero movie DVD will be coming soon. And you should look forward to that.
I really don't know what to say. That's kind of like the tightest 2 minutes of podcasting you've ever done. That's insane. I guess words and sentences now about how you should follow and help us with this podcast by commenting and liking and subscribing. Tell people. Tell your congressman. Let him know that the people need to hear this podcast. So the tentative plan was to do the animated series next week, but just in the middle of the podcast, Mike just threw down this just hissy fit of, no, we're not doing it. Complete mystery as to what's coming next week. I guess stay tuned. The Real World on Twitter and The Real World podcast on Facebook. I guess we'll announce it somewhere. Maybe. Who knows? Maybe we'll just hit you with a mystery vortex of an episode next week. But for now, I've been Matt Waters. He's been Mike Thomas. And he's already done Greek Chorus twice, so I don't know what his final zing is going to be this time.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have no idea what's coming next week. I have no joke for you.
Fantastic.